there are several men engaged who have to look out of factors and of blind windows to confuse the Baron. They want that the Baron makes a lot of noise, and they want that Fahrenheit comes to see the whole situation there. So the Baron comes in with Octavia, again dressed as Marianne, and there is a very amusing scene in which Octavia does so as if he is drunk in drinking the wine, and the Baron is very enchanted and wants to kiss him. At the moment when he wants to kiss him, he sees the face and remembers the face of Octavia, whom he hates certainly, who has wounded him in the second act, that he says, oh, this damn boy, you look exactly like a terrible boy whom I hate. And in this moment, a man looks out of a trapdoor, and there looks a man, and there looks a man, and he thinks he is crazy, and he starts to ring the bell, and a woman comes down, which is this Italian, and does so as if she is his wife, with four little children in her hand. He says, the children say always, papa, papa. We have cut quite a lot because Maestro Abravanel says they will all be off key and will not sing right. So we may not have so many children there. And in all this tohu wabohu, the police officer comes in, who has heard this noise. And it comes now to a kind of a questioning. He asks him who he is, and he says, I am Baron Erkenau, and this is Fräulein Fahrenheit, which makes Octavia absolutely tremble from fury, that he is so mean and so tactless to dare to take the name of his bride-to-be, as if she had a rendezvous with him in this disreputable inn here. And in the meantime, somebody has gone to call Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit comes in and sees all these and faints. And at least he sees for the first time that what kind of a person Baron Ox is. Now you know the Marshalin comes. And this is something which very few people understand why she comes. Even a man who should know it has told me an absolute wrong story about it. He thought that she comes to aid the Baron because he is her cousin. Not at all. The body servant of Baron Ox, who in reality is his illegitimate son, he has the idea to go to the Marshal and to ask the Marshal to come to help Baron Ox in this predicament. He comes to the Marshal and she asks him, what is the matter? And he says, look, he is there with Marianne. He is there with the maid of the Marshal. And the Marshal certainly knows that is Octavia. So she says to herself, why does Octavia do that? I have to go to the ground of that. And therefore she comes, not to help the Baron. She would never help him. She would never go to such an inn where no decent person really goes. But she goes because she is consumed by curiosity and by suspicion. Why does she do that? Is there perhaps a girl in the background? Does she do that for this Sophie Fahrenheit? She has figured that all out in her mind. And she comes and she sees the whole situation. And then when the Baron is thrown out by her, because she tells him no engagements, all off. And the three are alone. And now this wonderful trio starts. In which she sits down, and you know, she is not furious about Octavia. She is not furious that he has left her now, because she knew it would be so one day. Perhaps it is a little earlier than she likes it, but she was prepared. But she is very annoyed that Octavia doesn't behave like a man now, that Octavian doesn't come to her and says, forgive me, I have met this girl and I love her, forgive me. But he has not the courage to do that. And that makes her furious. And therefore, when Octavian stands there and talks to her, very embarrassed, she says to him, you are a fine man. Go over there and do what your heart commands. Which he does. And Sophie, who doesn't understand all of that at all, she had come with the father, by the way, she doesn't understand this whole situation. She feels instinctively that there is something strange between the great Marshal and her beloved Octavia. She doesn't know what it is. But she feels it is something which makes her embarrassed, which makes her annoyed. And therefore she is also annoyed with Octavian. The Marshaline sees that Octavian is not up to save the situation. So she takes it in her hand. She makes a decision, now I have to do what my decency orders me. I have to bring these two people together. And she goes over and she says to Sophie, you fell so quickly in love. And Sophie says, one has to understand that. One has to understand that I am very upset. And she talks and talks and talks in a very chatty way. And the Marshaline looks at her and thinks, really, about this young girl, Octavia is left. Isn't that terrible? Isn't it terrible? Who am I? And who is this chatty little girl? And just she's very pretty. That's all she is. But he has preferred this prettiness. All right, he must know what he does. And she says to Sophina, now you relax. I go in now to your father and I will invite him with me and with her and with the count to ride in my car to my castle, and there we will talk things over. And Octavian is quite overwhelmed of her kindness and thanks her. And he says, oh, how good you are. I don't think in this situation one likes very much to hear that one is so good. She says to him, I don't know what to say. And then comes this beautiful trio. After which she leaves, she goes in to Faninal and tells him, look, Faninal, your daughter loses a baron, but she wins a count. That's much better. She loses a rascal, and she wins a very enchanting young man. Don't you think? You say yes, and naturally he says yes. And he comes back, and this young couple stays alone, and they sing a love duet. When the Marshaline comes back, Faninal says to her, young people are like that. And the Marshaline says, yeah, yeah. And I have to tell you there a very funny story which happened to me. We made our recording in Vienna. And I had forgotten that I have to sing yeah, yeah. The trio was over. And it has been a very tiring day. We had repeated very often. And I went home very happy. And suddenly, they reached this point and no Marshaline was there. And they couldn't wait, because it was rather late, time is money. They couldn't wait to call me back. So Elizabeth Schumann, who was a Sophie, said, oh, you have not to, I can copy her. So what you hear on the old record of Rosenkavalier, yeah, that's Elisabeth Schumann. Oh. So this is the story of Rosenkavalier, and I hope that you have understood it very well and that you will enjoy it now very much. Because our performance, I hope, will be wonderful with all the misgivings of Maestro Abravanel. I hope it will be very good. We have an excellent cast. We have a very good orchestra. We have a marvelous conductor. Karl Zitowski helps me very much with the stage. directing, and Frank Post has outdone himself in the stage settings, which are absolutely enchanting, which he has designed and created. And they are exactly as I had wanted. It's the first act in these subdued traditional nobility. It's the second act more glaring because that will be the taste of the nouveau riche. He likes very, very light things. And then the last act rather subdued till the moment that the Marshalin comes and brings all the glamour into the room. Now, do you want to hear something about Strauss himself?
Yeah.
I met Strauss for the first time in Vienna in 1960. On the occasion of Ariadne, of the premiere of Ariadne of Naxos, the newly Neubearbeitung, what house one calls it?
The new version
of Ariadne. I had as an understudy the part of the composer. The part of the composer was really written by Strauss for a very wonderful singing actress in Vienna, Marie Gutheil Schoder, who had sung a lot of Strauss roles. She was not very young anymore, and her voice was not quite what it had been in earlier years, but she was a great personality, and I had a real crush on her. I had her pictures everywhere and adored her. And that made it a little easier for me that I had this role only as an understudy, because in Hamburg, from where I came in 1916, I had already sung my whole repertory and was a very well-known singer. But one of the last rehearsals, Marie Gutheil Schoder was sick and canceled the rehearsal. And I was called. And I said, oh my God, I don't know the role really. I have looked at it. I will make terrible mistakes. I don't know it. And they said, oh, but you are quite unimportant. I mean, just come and give the cues. But, I mean, Richard Strauss is there, Hofmannsthal is there, and otherwise we have to cancel the whole rehearsal. So I came, and after this rehearsal was over, Strauss took me aside and said to me, I want you to come this afternoon. I want to do this role with you. And I was very happy. I thought, oh, perhaps I get it. Third or fourth performance or so. And he rehearsed with me, and then he said very quietly, you will sing the premiere. And now the strange thing happened that as much as I was overwhelmed by joy, at the same time, my adoration for Marie Gutheil Schoder was so great that I said to him, I cannot do that. And Hans Gregor, our director, he was there, and he has written later on in his memoirs, this was the only time in his whole career that a singer has refused out of because she adores another singer. I will not make myself noble. I mean, this was really only because I had such a crush on Marie Gutheil Schoder. And when Strauss said to me, you just do what we tell you, you sing the premiere, I cannot say that I fought like a lion. Really the beginning of my career, this Strauss premiere, because the eyes of the whole world were on this performance, and I had a very great success with it. And you know, Strauss was a very aloof person. One really came never quite near him. He was a strange mixture of being very bourgeois. It sounds strange, but it's true. Bourgeois and the genius doesn't go together, but he was that. Wasn't it? Am I not right, Maurice? When one watched him in his daily life, he was rather disappointing. He was, for instance, a very henpecked husband. His wife was a terrible shrew. He loved her very much, and for him there existed only one woman on earth, that was Pauline, his wife. And I have told this story already, but I repeat it, how they came to an engagement He was as a young conductor, he conducted Tannhäuser, and she sang Elisabeth. She was a singer. I think quite a good one, but not. I don't think she was so very outstanding. And she made a mistake, and he corrected her, and said she didn't like that, and she threw something on his head. he interrupted the rehearsal, and he was very furious, and went to her green room. And there, the people outside, they heard furious shouting and shrieking, and had the feeling one murders another one, and then was deep silence. And then some gentlemen from the orchestra came, and they knocked at the door, and Strauss appeared, and they said, "Herr Doctor, we have decided that our orchestra will never play again when Miss Diana is going to sing." And he said, "That I would regret very much, because I have just got engaged." He himself has told me that several times, by the way. He always repeated things. And he was very naive. In that time, I knew some very poor jokes in a Hamburg dialect. And he annoyed me so that from time to time he said, "Lotte, tell me these jokes in Hamburg dialect." I said, "Herr Doctor, these are the same old jokes. I don't know anything anymore." He said, "Never mind, I want to listen to it." So I was more than 2 weeks a guest in his house in Garmisch when I studied with him the wife of the dyer in Frauenschatten, the woman without shadow. And I saw the whole family life. The whole family life consisted of mostly Pauline shrieking through the whole household. And nothing what he did was right. He was scolded about everything on earth. And I cannot understand that he could stand this and that he liked it. When I went away, he said to me, "Lotte, now you can write an article, can make a lot of money when you write down what you have seen in our house. But you have also to add to that article that I have said to you that the adoration of the whole world is for me not as important as my wife." It's quite wonderful. But she didn't appreciate that at all. She said to me one day, "You know, I could have married the lieutenant." And I said to her, "Now don't expect me to break into tears that you are the wife of the most famous composer of all times." "Oh," she said, "his music, I don't like his music. I think his music is terrible. What I like is Mignon and Manon. That's music, these are melodies, but Richard's music, I hate it." And when we had when we had the premiere of Intermezzo in Dresden, where I sang the wife of the composer, that is really his own life, an episode was out of his life, and he has written the libretto himself. And he came to write it in a very strange way. He had asked Hofmannsthal to write it. And Hofmannsthal wrote it and brought it to him. And Strauss read it and he said to him, "But you made an absolute shrew out of my wife." And Hofmannsthal said, "I'm sorry, that's how I see it." So Strauss did it himself and Strauss has written it. Really, it is all, and he has pictured her as very hysterical and rather crazy, but really as a very lovable person. And when we were, I remember the situation, we went in the elevator at the hotel, the elevator was full of people, and I said to her, "Pauline, is it not wonderful, really, that you have that Richard has written such a monument, has given you eternity?" "Oh, I just whistle at that eternity," she said. "I'm not interested at all. I think this is a terrible opera." And the people at all were absolutely taken aback, and Strauss was very red in his face. When before Intermezzo came, he wanted me to sing in Dresden. And he made it really an, and condition that I would see the premiere, and the people in Dresden were not very happy about it. They naturally wanted somebody from their opera to sing the main part. And but he insisted, and so they engaged me. And before I went away, he said to me, "Now listen, you play now the great prima donna. Everybody hates you there. You come now and show them." And I said, "You didn't tell me that. I cannot. I have never in my life succeeded to be the great prima donna. I hate this kind of female. I cannot do that. I have only to be." He said, "Now then you will be lost. You will be lost. You have to be." But it was not so. They, in the beginning, they were not nice, but later on, I think they rather liked me. I have written down some of these incidents. I thought I would not have any use of this, but my memory is all eaten up by Rosenkavalier, I think. Yeah, when I was in Garmisch, every morning Pauline had a massage of a person who tore the flesh off her bones. This is really true. She, Pauline had the feeling one was slender and it is very healthy if the whole flesh is always taken off the flesh, and she wanted of the bones, and she wanted me to have this massage too, because she took my arm and she said, "Oh, this is terrible. This is terrible. This is nothing loose here. You have to have this massage." And I said, "No, I thank you kindly. I don't do that." And then I went to Strauss and I said to Strauss, "Now listen, doctor, I don't want this massage, but you know Pauline, she will send." And he said, "No, be very energetic, don't do it." And I tell you why. When Pauline has this massage, sometimes she shrieks so terribly in agony that I go away. I want to compose in the morning, and I have to run away. I go up and down in the garden because I cannot stand it anymore. And she is shrieking. And I said, "But if it's her pleasure, why don't you let her shriek?" Frauds are very brutal. He loved her very much. Then one afternoon, I remember, we were all sitting with coffee and kuchen in the garden, and suddenly came a thunderstorm. And we had to run in and take all the everything in. And Strauss, Pauline was very furious and scolded him about that thunderstorm. And I said to her, "For heaven's sake, Richard may be a god, but he has not arranged the thunderstorm." And he took me aside and he said, like a little boy, "Don't defend me, it makes it only worse." Yeah, in the evening in Garmisch, he used to play for me old songs. And then Pauline was terribly sentimental. Then they embraced each other, and with tears streaming down her face. These were the old memories. It was terribly embarrassing for me. And I had to sing all these songs which she had almost forgotten. But it was really, these were the hours that I really saw the artist again, which did me good, because seeing him so always scolded and pushed in a corner was really very disillusioned. You may want to know how I liked him as a conductor. I really didn't like very much to sing Strauss. I tell you why. He was always like a monument. You never could see in his face if he liked something or if he disliked it. It was always like a stone face. And I had always liked very much the contact with the conductor. I liked this give and take, which is the ideal in between musicians. And when I sang, I wanted to see if the conductor liked what I did. But I never did, with Strauss never. So I think it was just a great inner tension, perhaps, because a man who writes so fiery music must have inside a fiery temperament. It would be impossible otherwise. Once I remember I sang Octavian in that time, and I made very many mistakes, I remember. And suddenly he was furious. Suddenly, and after the act was over, he came. And he wanted to scold me. He was quite red in his face. And when he came in, I said, "Herr Doctor, I am very happy. I succeeded in making your face expressive." He couldn't say a word, he started to laugh. Once in Walküre, I remember, in Walküre, something in the orchestra went wrong, and he looked furiously at the orchestra. Now, I was never in my life a very correct singer, and if something went wrong, I always felt immediately, am I the one? I did that. So I thought that immediately that I did it, but I was in my inhibited youth, very, very wild and very without inhibitions. And when this act was over, I tore off my wig and went in my room and said, "I don't sing anymore. I don't allow anybody to make faces at me." And he came and he said, "Are you nuts? What's the matter with you? I didn't mean you at all." I said, "Oh, you didn't mean me." Now then he brought me a glass of water and we laughed. And after he had left, Pauline came in, raging. She said, "I am so happy you gave it to him." I said to her, "But look, it was nonsense. He didn't mean me at all, so it was really nonsense what I did." She said, "Nonsense or not, but you gave him something and I'm so happy." Everybody always lies on the floor before him, which, by the way, he disliked thoroughly. He didn't like it that one made the first. And I think that was a reason that he, in his very detached way, rather liked me, because I always fought with him. And I have often written him very rude letters when he did something which I didn't like. And I had a letter from him one day in which he wrote, in which he quoted Hans Sachs, when Beckmesser says, "A letter, a verse from Sachs, that will mean something." So his letter started, "A letter from Lotte, that will mean something. When I opened your letter, I thought, oh my God, what have I done now?" But then I saw that you wrote very nicely to me, and I am happily surprised. He was very reluctant with praise. If he liked something, a smile went over his face, and he said, "Very good." And I have now the dream that after our performances are over, that I can see in my imagination the face of Strauss and his half-embarrassed smile, and hearing him say, "Very good."